to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there from Bedford. Yes, I'm back home in the motherland. How are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I have an interview with Chris Beniski, a partner at Placeholder and the author of the book Crypto Assets. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. So let's talk about BlockFi. In the last few shows, I've announced that I'm going to be getting on the phone with Zach Prince, the CEO, to discuss some of the questions around their new product relating to crypto interest accounts. There's been a lot of questions about this, a lot of debate. So when I spoke with Zach, he was like, well, look, put it out to your audience, Pete. You can let anyone send me questions. We can get on the phone. I'll give complete transparency. I'll answer everything they have to say. And it's been pretty cool. I've had probably a handful of emails now, four or five, with people outlining all the different questions they've got. So if you do have questions, if you've got concerns, please just email me. As I said, Zach's going to get on the phone with me next week. I'm going to put all the questions to him. We're going to record it and we're going to put it up on SoundCloud for anyone to listen to. And I think that's pretty cool. I think that's really pretty decent of Zach to open the floor up, to be transparent like this. I try and run my business transparently and I just think this is probably why our partnership works so well. So if you do have any questions for Zach, drop me an email on hello@whatbitcoindid.com and I will put them to him next week. And let's also talk about my other brand new sponsor, Flubit. Have you checked them out yet? I really highly recommend you do, actually, not just because they're a sponsor, but I've actually been back a couple of times now. I've bookmarked them because I think it's quite funny. Most of us get tied up into using Amazon all the time because, you know, convenience. And they've just always been that kind of number one e-commerce store. But I really do like this feature on the Flubit site, which allows you to search with that checkbox for items cheaper than Amazon. It's really quite cool, actually. So yeah, anything you're looking to buy, if you head over on Flubit.com, type it in, click on the checkbox, and it will show you if they've got items cheaper than Amazon. And also, the other great thing is you can pay with crypto. So you can pay with your Bitcoin, your Ether, Litecoin, and Mew. Mew's not something I know about, so I haven't really checked that out. But for me, I can pay in Bitcoin. And as I said in the previous ad, I've bought five copies of Andreas's The Internet of Money. Bought it with my own Bitcoin. I've got a delivery note, so it should be here in the next couple of days. I'm going to give those away on Twitter. So definitely keep an eye on that. Definitely check them out. Check out the way you can search for items cheaper than Amazon. It's at flubit.com, which is FLUBIT.com. Okay, so on to my interview with Chris Beniski. And yeah, this is someone I've wanted to interview for a while. When I first launched the podcast, I reached out to him, but obviously I didn't have much of an audience and he's a really busy person, so it didn't happen. But I've chipped away at him over the year, and also quite a few people have tagged him in posts saying he should come on the show. And recently he followed me, so we started a conversation and we agreed when I got to New York we would meet up. So this was great because his book, Crypto Assets, An Innovative Investor's Guide to Bitcoin and Beyond, was the first book I read in the sector. I think I read it before I read Digital Gold, actually. And listen, while I don't agree with a lot of it now, I'm still a big fan of Chris. I mean, I'm pretty much just a Bitcoiner. I've got a material small amount of Monero, but I have maintained a kind of healthy curiosity in other crypto assets. And while I'm not sure if any of them will exist in, you know, 5-10 years time, I do maintain a curiosity both for myself and also just to try and understand why people have an interest in altcoins and why not everyone is just a Bitcoin maximalist. So it's really great to hear from Chris why he believes in this so much, why he has such an interest, why Placeholder and put in so much money into this sector. So yeah, I hope you enjoy the interview. I fully expect there'll be a bunch of people who won't. There'll be some maximalists who want to tear me apart and stomp on my face for doing it. But look, feedback is welcome. I think it's healthy to look into these items. And just a note, there has been quite a bit of intensity on Twitter. A lot of people taking an issue recently with some of my guests and some of the ways I've handled the interviews. I've added a guest policy onto my website if you want to read it. Feedback is welcome. It includes my disclosures, my sponsor policy, and some of the things I will and won't accept. I think I've wasted too much time recently trying to defend my guest choices and trying to correct the spread of misinformation and misrepresentations about why I do things. It's just really zapping of time and energy. Go and read it. If you've got any feedback, let me know. And if you enjoy the show and if you want to support it, there's a section on my website that explains everything you can do. Just head over to whatbitcoindid.com, click on the support section. And yeah, if you've got any questions about the interview, get in touch. If you're a regular listener, you probably know my email address, but for anyone else, it's hello@whatbitcoindid.com. So the interview we're doing is pretty timely as well, because we chatted a bit over email. It's been a long time coming. And I've obviously read your book. I've read it, I think, three times now. I've got it here with me. And wondering what we were going to talk about. And your first point was that you're bullish on Bitcoin. And I've had quite the 3 weeks on Twitter. I don't know how much you've seen of it, but I've been at the wrath of the maximalists. Yeah. But
it happens to almost everyone.
Yes. My problem is I'm very defensive. And I feel like I need to defend each point, which I'm learning not to do. Really, I should mute and have a break. So I'm going to have a break for a while now. But I switch between sympathizing and almost agreeing entirely with Maximus, but then have this other curiosity. And now, because of what's happened this week, if people know I'm interviewing you, the wearer of your book will be considered as part of the threat model to Bitcoin.
Hmm.
You must be aware of that.
Yes.
You've had plenty of...
I've been at the wrath of the maximalist many times. You've seen it on Twitter.
I've seen it. So I'm going to approach this with some healthy skepticism, and but also...
As you should.
As I should, and a curiosity. I think firstly, just to set the scene, it would be great if you explained who placeholder are, what you're invested in, what your investment strategy is, and then we can go from there.
Sure. And I do want to come back to Bitcoin and hopefully teasing apart how Bitcoin is not synonymous with the maximalists, right? And there are many, say, flavors of communities that support Bitcoin and believe in Bitcoin. And placeholder is definitely one of those. So a little bit about placeholder. Back half of 2017, myself, Joel Monegro, and Brad Burnham raised a $150 million venture fund. At the time, there were predominantly hedge funds, but we chose a venture fund model where the capital is committed over a 10-year period. So there are no redemptions, and we're not subject to the whims of the market in the amount of capital that we have to deploy. And so it really creates this cocoon of capital where we can focus on supporting our portfolio teams with a really long time horizon. So 10-year fund is really the time scale that we're thinking on. And we raised the fund with a focus on the progression of, say, value accrual within information technology, going from hardware to software to data to governance, which is something we can circle back to if you'd like. And that thesis remains. We continue to layer in things. Definitely had an early focus on developers. Starting early 2018, started to complement that focus with what has now, say, blossomed into the decentralized finance community, really with the realization that, okay, financial services tends to be one of the earliest adopters of new technology. Blockchains are natively financial technologies in that they collapse the cost of asset creation, custody, and transfer, and that we have to nail those use cases, say, within financial verticals to really open up, say, more of the technology verticals. And so that's where we've made investments in things like 0x or MakerDAO and Erasure, which was recently announced. All of our investments are on our website, placeholder.vc. So just reading them from the top, it would be 0x, Aragon, Bitcoin, Cash Cash, which is a content delivery network, Decred, Erasure, Filecoin, Foam, MakerDAO, OSCoin, which has recently had some buzz around it. It's a decentralized GitHub, UMA, Universal Market Access, Financial Contracts, and then Zeppelin OS.
Okay. And obviously you wrote the book, what was it, 2-3 years ago now?
Started writing it end of 2016.
End of 2016.
And then published it September of 2017.
So it was the first thing I read in the sector. And the first time I read it, under the belief that everything in it was true. Some of it went over my head, but it was a very good intro into the crypto world. I'm less of a crypto investor now. I hold Bitcoin and Monero. I have curiosity elsewhere, but quite a lot of skepticism. But you pretty much put yourself out there into the arena to produce this book, and it has been highly commended, but also highly criticized.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a good 2 to 3 years on from when you started it. How do you reflect on the book now?
I think it's important to go back to what the period was like when we wrote the book, because I met Jack, my co-author, at Consensus 2016, and I had recently published a few months prior a white paper with Coinbase called Bitcoin Ringing the Bell for a New Asset Class, which by and large the maximalists loved. But I had written that paper really to argue, okay, Bitcoin is extremely important. And if you're not paying attention to Bitcoin, you're missing the boat. But Bitcoin is also a early indication of what's to come. And that had a strong reception within the financial and tech communities. And when I met Jack, met him randomly, he sat down next to me at lunch at Consensus, and we were talking, and he had been a writer and is a writer for different news outlets. And he pitched me on the idea of doing a book, and I thought it was a joke at first, and it actually started to materialize and become something real. And at that point in time, you know, you had, say, books about Bitcoin. Like, one of my favorite books that I read when I was ramping in the space was Understanding Bitcoin by Pedro Franco. Innocuous title, but very in-depth on, you know, the economics and cryptography. So, and of course, there's Andreas's books. But you had books on the technicals, or you had books on the history, right? Things like digital gold. But at the time, we didn't have a book that covered the asset class as a whole, that said, hey, Bitcoin is the first of its kind, but there are going to be many more. And what is a potential framework for approaching what's going on here? And so this was really an attempt to take us beyond thinking of this new asset class as relegated to currencies alone, but instead recognizing, okay, we have a natively financial technology, as we went over, collapses the cost of asset custody, creation, and transfer. And so that is going to open up this entire world of programmable value. How do we prepare ourselves for that as investors? And so that was really the genesis of the book. Got the book deal late in 2016, wrote it over, you know, a period of 4 months. It was an aggressive timeline, and had to submit the rough draft end of March. But March is when, March 10th, 2017, is when the Winklevoss ETF was rejected that Friday. And that's when Ether popped like 20%. And then all of the other crypto assets started rallying. And that really kicked off, and we can circle back to that, but that kicked off the heat, say, of the 2017 bull market. And so everything started changing before our eyes as we were writing the book. And I actually became horribly insecure about the book before publishing, and feeling that it was incomplete. And, you know, my insecurities are something else entirely. But I think it was, for its time, a good first attempt. We may do a second edition. I may do, you know, a totally separate book. But, you know, now it feels a little outdated, but I think still relevant.
Well, it felt to me more like a prediction of the future, what could be, rather than a statement of fact.
Yes. Yes. And I never want to say this is exactly what the future is going to look like, because anyone who tells you they know exactly what the future is going to look like is lying. We can't possibly know.
And are there any parts of the book now that you, on reflection, think are wrong, or areas you've explored that stand out to you that you really do want to rewrite?
Well, when we wrote the ICO section, there's one chapter, The Wild West of ICOs. I think that could have been a book in and of itself, right? And given how fast things were evolving, I think we could have done a more robust job with that section. Someone on Twitter has called out that we should have covered the risks more. We did have two chapters on the history of financial bubbles, and weaving in examples of crypto bubbles, and trying to prepare investors for all the different potential schemes that they may encounter. So really did our best to discuss the risks in the book, but I think could have done more. There's just a very specific thing. You know, I got ported in late 2016, where they moved my phone number and then broke into my email, and, you know, everything waterfalled from there. I wish I'd put in a section about, you know, protecting proper security hygiene with two-factor authentication. So there's all kinds of things. But now, you know, the debate, because I kind of do feel the urge to embark on another book. It's kind of like writing a book is it's an intellectual birth. And then there's a period of exhaustion. And I feel like I'm recovering from that. And so a book is pinging around in my mind. And I think the question is whether to do a second edition of this or to do something completely new. And the thing that pulls me towards doing something completely new is just exploring new things. My dad used to say all creativity comes at the cost of maintenance. And I don't like the idea of maintaining this book and it becoming this dry, rote exercise. I much prefer the idea of a intellectual exploration in writing a new book. And it may be less refined, but it's a journey that the reader takes with me. And we all know that we're figuring out this space together.
Okay, so just back to the fund. What is the split between equity and token-based investments?
Thus far, every single investment we've made has been with an eye on the eventual crypto asset, not with an eye on the cash flow extracting equity capitalized business. That said, we have made investments in equities, LLCs, or whatever it may be. But we think of those as a placeholder development company, where actually pre-network launch, it can align investors with the developers most cohesively to raise in an equity structure, and then actually dissolve that structure. There are different ways to handle it upon network launch to get the eventual claim on the tokens.
So you are also bullish on Bitcoin?
Yes, absolutely. We hold Bitcoin and large amount of Bitcoin in the portfolio.
And are you able to say kind of what level investment you've made in Bitcoin, or do you have to keep those? Is that confidential?
It is one of our largest investments.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about Bitcoin first.
Sure.
And then I want to talk about tokens, and I want to talk about the way a fund invests in tokens and the way it extracts value and whether there is value, because I have got some skepticism. I don't hold any anymore now because of that. I am curious.
Skepticism is healthy.
Yeah, well, yeah, for a number of reasons, but we'll come to that. So let's go to Bitcoin itself. I like to ask people in almost every interview now this same question, and I'm always intrigued by the answer. It changes every time. But what is Bitcoin?
I think the easiest way to describe Bitcoin is money over IP, money over internet protocol. And just as voice over internet protocol, things like Skype and WhatsApp calls have revolutionized our ability to connect with anyone anywhere in the world for zero cost. Bitcoin as a money over IP, you know, rips out all of the pre-existing sludge of our financial system and the interconnects and all of the things that take up time and cost, and just says, here's this global network for communicating or transmitting value at low cost.
Okay, interesting. So I've heard that before, actually, and people talk about it as internet money, but I sometimes struggle with that because I would argue that a stable coin is a better money over the internet because it's closer to money. I don't like stable coins, by the way. I'm not a huge fan, but I think they are more realistic money over IP because they peg to money and do a very similar thing to Bitcoin.
So this is where I think of a money as a store value, means of exchange, okay, and unit of account. And the crux of that progression first being a good store of value. And we see Bitcoin doing just that. I share some of your concerns around the means of exchange, and I think it's TBD. I also read the Bitcoin Standard, and I'm good friends with Murad, and I understand, say, the points and the thinking around their intended progression of Bitcoin. I think that if you follow, say, the line of thinking within the Bitcoin Standard, where, you know, the argument there is that the world has been infected with inflationary assets and that we actually need to go back to deflationary assets, and that sets up all the right spending and saving patterns, and so on and so forth. And I think it's a very elegant thesis and enjoyed reading the book. I think something that I haven't figured out for myself yet is what happens when the majority of the world still operates under an inflationary regime, and Bitcoin is a significant store of value, but say not the majority store of value. I think it's very hard psychologically for people to spend something that is deflationary when the world is mostly inflationary. And I'm talking about supply schedules here. And so does that require us to assume that Bitcoin needs to get to majority value capture of the world's assets, or at least the world's monetary bases, in order to, say, have this? It's really a behavioral switch, a psychological switch. And that's asking a lot, right? And that could happen. But I don't think I have enough information here and now in 2019 to say that that's the likely outcome.
How confident and bullish are you with Bitcoin?
Over the next 10 years, I'm extremely bullish.
Okay. And how bullish are you with Bitcoin then compared to your investments in tokens? Because I guess with tokens, there's still a lot more to prove.
Yes.
Is this a calculated bet?
Well, everything's a calculated investment. And, you know, there's the expected value being the probability multiplied by the reward. And so there's so many things with Bitcoin. I guess, you know, where does my fundamental conviction in Bitcoin lie? I think it comes down to being maybe the most perfect instantiation of the commodity theory of money that we've seen, in terms of it was the first crypto asset And because of that, it priced every subsequent crypto asset, and it was the most liquid crypto asset. And so it has become the bloodline of liquidity for the entire ecosystem. And because it prices everything else, it is intractable, right? And this isn't a technology thing. This is a social thing. And it's not something that can be taken away from Bitcoin, but it is something that Bitcoin can lose. And so when I approach Bitcoin, say, from looking at the many competitors out there, I don't think of those competitors as being able to take anything away from Bitcoin, because what Bitcoin built happens so organically, and it's so entrenched in the ecosystem. And so that gives me a lot of conviction in the context of a retail hodler of Bitcoin. You know, it's an amazing store of value. And I think the other thing I'd layer in there is the type of scarcity that Bitcoin has. You could really only create that in a digital world. It is so artificially scarce. And with its supply schedule that converges on a 0% rate of inflation, you can't have that with physical commodity monies. And so being set up as the perfectly scarce asset, I think that's a fascinating psychological experiment that should be directionally positive for the price. So say that's retail, a retail perspective for myself as a retail hodler. And then from placeholder, you know, the more institutional perspective, I gave you the commodity theory of money, but also holding it as a reserve asset of crypto and a potential cash equivalent, right? We've seen with prior cycles that Bitcoin and say some of the other macro assets have this seesaw effect with the other assets where say Bitcoin will rally as the unit of account, it might suck some of the air out of the room, right? There's a liquidity crunch in the other assets. And so Bitcoin on a relative basis appreciates. And so you can actually use it at that point to buy some of the underperforming crypto assets. And so as we build out this broader portfolio and a significant Bitcoin position, even though we are a venture fund, you may see us taking some of our Bitcoin position and buying other crypto assets if Bitcoin has rallied strongly and some of the other assets that we have conviction in the underlying fundamentals haven't shown that life in the market yet.
So, I mean, I'm like you, I'm bullish on Bitcoin, but as I said, I've got a huge amount of skepticism with tokens now. And I think it's going to be very interesting to explore that with you, because I guess one of the things for you is your reputation is predicated on the success of tokens, right? If the whole model turns out
my professional reputation.
Yeah, your
my personal life is something else entirely.
That's what I mean. Your professional reputation is predicated on the success of tokens. You know, you've been ballsy enough to write the book and put yourself out there and say, this is what you believe. But at the same time, that comes with risk. You know, we know how brutal and savage Twitter can be at times. I mean, you can close your laptop off and get away. But so I'm interested to learn about why you're bullish, because my skepticism comes from more just having a general feeling this, a lot of this doesn't make sense.
A lot of it doesn't make sense.
Well, a lot of it doesn't.
95%.
Yeah. Potentially more, I think, to be proven. But also, one of the other things that makes me just a bit of a sour taste is that I think funds can extract value from their investment before the technology is proven by extracting value when the tokens go on, say, public sale. I've interviewed Ari Paul, Carl Samani, here with yourself now. And that's one of the things that I have a slight concern about.
I have the same concern.
Okay, so let's unwrap this. So let's start with, convince me that there is a model in the future for people to buy and use tokens in these networks.
Sure. I actually may not convince you of that.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't know that the model is so much a demand side focused model as much as a supply side focused model. And that would be more the creators of the service as opposed to the consumers of the service. But stepping back for a moment, you know, we just discussed Bitcoin, right? And Bitcoin has proven that a purely digital asset on a decentralized ledger can be a store of value. And if you go back to 2015, the last bear market, that wasn't a stronghold, an intellectual stronghold, the way it is now. And it's hard to imagine now the uncertainty that was there then. And even if you take traditional finance in that period, I was at different conferences where, you know, it was blockchain, not Bitcoin mania, and was dismissed, right? And so just understanding that there are these psychological shifts that happen, and in the early and especially in the first bear market that follows the creation of a new movement, there is bound and it is natural that there be a lot of uncertainty. And I wrote a post on this called The Best Time to Build and Buy Tokens that really explains the psychological progression. So that's the starter of say, okay, Bitcoin has made it through this journey of conviction, and the other crypto assets are much earlier in their journey. And why do we think they fundamentally have value? I would say that the majority of what we're seeing in the market today is more an evolution and replacement for equity than a replacement for currencies. Not Bitcoin. Bitcoin, as we just discussed, and some like it, like Monero or Zcash, and really hard proof of work based assets. And we can come back to value accrual through proof of work in a moment. But those assets are focused on currencies. But a lot of the ones that are stake based or bonding based or whatever it may be are actually organizing a supply side that is provisioning a service, a supranational service, and enforcing the rules and governance and evolution of that service in such a way that if it works out, right, the supply side that is holding that asset gets claimed to the value flows of that service. And that is actually very much a discounted value flow model, similar to how an equity would be valued. And it's different from an equity in terms of the third party. You know, if you go to the Howey test, the efforts of others and this third party is a very amorphous third party. It's really this collective. Who is the third party in this instance? It's also very different from an equity in that an equity, you have passive collection of dividends. Whereas when you're organizing a supply side, the crypto assets base is partially productive, right? Partially value flow producing, partially non-productive, partially a consumable transformable, which is where people kind of get stuck. And so the productive base, you have to be an active participant in that network in order to get value flows, which from an egalitarian perspective is very important, right? I would say, and Joel, my partner, has done a lot of great work thinking around how equity has led to some of the inequalities we see in the world today. But the fact that you have to be an active participant to get access to the value flows is a very important component of any crypto asset. And so if I were to, say, lay forth a framework, and I need to put out a piece on this soon, the framework coming from a valuation perspective, you can think of broadly there being three superclasses of assets. And stop me if at any point this is unclear, but three superclasses of assets where there are capital assets, which are typically thought of as cash flow producing, right? So bonds, equities, income producing real estate, those kinds of things. There are consumable transformable assets, which are more your typical commodities, oil, wheat, natural gas, metals. And then there are your store value assets. So, you know, fine wines, arts, rare automobiles. And if you take something like gold, it can be both a consumable, transformable, and a store value asset. And Bitcoin, I would argue, is the same, right? Holding a Bitcoin doesn't give you a claim on any value flows. You can't stake a Bitcoin to be a participant in the network. And so I actually think the best way to value those assets is still through the equation of exchange, MV equals PQ, which is what I put out in 2017. But interestingly enough, the majority of crypto assets are shaping up to be capital assets, to be things that organize and are useful predominantly to the supply side. And so I think that the majority of value accrual for those assets will be through a discounted value flow model. And what's really interesting is there's overlap, though, where let's say Ethereum goes to proof of stake, right? It is predominantly a capital asset, but where it's used to pay for gas, it's a consumable transformable. And so I think it becomes a sum of the parts valuation where it's predominantly discounted value flow for the supply siders, but there's a little bit of value capture through MV equals PQ. And you know, as I discussed with the original valuation piece, velocity becomes a problem, and you know, all of those considerations taken into account. But I lay the framework to really try and, again, as I did originally with the book, try and piece apart how different these systems are, and therefore the value capture will be, so that we can stop bickering over, you know, your approach is bad because it's different from my approach. It's not that at all. It's just they're fundamentally different approaches trying to solve different things.
There'll be a number of people who will listen to this who won't understand a lot of what you've talked about there. but who have the ability to invest. I think these are quite complicated decisions that people have to make, but they're making loosely. So I'm still struggling to understand what is so broken in the current equity model that the token is fixing. You've said maybe because it opens up access to investors who don't normally have access, but it also is changing the, it does change the value model. Its success is predicated on the appreciation of the token in value. But then with most of these networks, it's not useful to have a volatile price. So that's where one of my conflicts comes, that I think most, for example, in the utility space, which has a lot to be proven, almost every instance, it would make much more sense if these were stable coins.
So two things in there, say what's broken with equity and say the utility token model. Let's start with the utility token model. And actually the word utility token, I don't really like because it's too broad of a bucket. It's really just saying anything that has utility that's not a currency or strictly a currency. I guess I don't even really know what the utility token definition is. But suffice to say, it's very diverse, right? There's a lot of diversity within, say, what people consider a utility token. What I was trying to get at with the capital asset component is actually these assets, say Ethereum proof of stake, or you know, you're going to have Keep network launch or all these different things, or we see it with LivePeer. They organize the supply side, the providers of the service, and they are useful to the supply siders in enforcing the governance and the behavior of those supply siders to ensure consistency of the service. They're not so useful to the demand side. And I actually very easily see a world where the demand side doesn't operate with that native asset at all. They pay in whatever stable coin, whatever fiat coin, whatever it may be that they want. And it actually doesn't matter because the value flow that the supply side ends up getting from staking the native asset is really what will define the value capture of that native asset. And so I think people obsess on the utility token side, on the demand side, the consumers of the service. And what I'm saying is, I think that's right to say obsess over the problems with that, but you can't stop there. You have to say, look at the other side of the equation, which is the supply side, where I think there's a lot more, say, value capture and usefulness in constructing the service. And ultimately, these crypto networks are only going to win. They're only going to sustain themselves and truly provide value if they provide a novel service, right, that people can't help but use, or provide an on-par service to existing companies, but for an order of magnitude cheaper. And that's just the economic reality of things. And so, you know, that's a very sort of cut and dry goal. In terms of, say, what's wrong with equity, I think in the, as we've watched the progression of equity, right, invented in the early 1600s and the kinds of businesses that it capitalized, early on, those businesses weren't exponential in the services that they created and the value that they captured. And there was always significant marginal cost to producing an incremental unit. As we have marched along through the Industrial Revolution and now into information technology, the scale of the services provided has very much become exponential, power law based. And the marginal cost of producing incremental units is zero. And so I would say one of the core fundamental problems with equity in the world we have today is actually the lopsidedness of value capture and a relatively concentrated base of shareholders that unilaterally hold access to value capture and also control of that service. And these services, you take things like Facebook or Amazon or Google, I would argue we as a globe are dependent upon them, but the ownership is extremely concentrated and is one of the contributors to the wealth and income inequality that we see in the world today. And so for the digital services where it makes sense, and again, totally realizing and understanding that it won't make sense for every digital service, but I think for some or many digital services, a crypto network's model to capitalize and incentivize the supply siders, the investors, potentially the demand siders, as this broader collective that has access to the value and the control of the service that's provided, that intuitively to me feels like the right thing, right? And we have a technology which is at a very early stage, but that we know is highly programmable. And so for me to constrain myself in thinking it's only going to be used for this one thing actually feels ludicrous. You know, I couldn't possibly say all the things that this are going to be used for.
So we'll come to that as well. So just referring back to equity, so one of the things that I think about is I understand when you say the ownership is concentrated on a small group of people. That's obviously because of the way equity deals are structured with from venture capital. But isn't there an argument also that this is there's some benefit to this because companies become incubated, they have support structures in place from the VCs, they have somebody who joins the board, and they incubate them without these companies having to worry about value or the liquidity of their assets. They just can focus on solving their product market fit. Yet in the crypto world, where we've seen this kind of change where anyone can invest early on, and we've kind of had this wild west of ICOs and companies as such being built from it, which don't seem to have the same kind of level of rigor around what they're producing.
Sure.
So there's a trade-off.
There's definitely a trade-off.
And I'm not sure if that's a good trade-off. And I'm also not sure if liquidity is useful before product market fit has been achieved.
Right. It can be more a bug than a feature.
Yeah.
And I think that we're very early on in understanding and evolving the governance standards within crypto networks. But that's not to say that we'll never figure them out. And again, going back to say the fundamentals of this as a technology that collapses the cost of asset creation, custody, and transfer, and really the programmability of that, and a vote being a very valuable asset, I again have a hard time seeing a world where we don't figure out improved ways to coordinate and govern using this technology versus, you know, our paper trails of days past. Now, in terms of, you know, the benefits to a concentrated shareholdership and, say, centralization allowing a faster pace of execution, I think there's merit to that argument. And it all goes back to, as you said, trade-offs and how these networks are being set up. And I think we are taking learnings from the equity world, right? As we, particularly placeholder, finance the early development of pre-launch networks. Setting the pre-launch development aside for a moment and looking at, say, equilibrium operations, I think that a very important thing is once we have governance figured out and we've hit this more stable, steady state, the fact that the supply siders, the provisioners of the service, have equal voice and access to value flows as the investors in the service is very important, right? Because investors are important, as you pointed out, for getting something off the ground. But does that mean they should have a perpetual claim on cash flows forevermore with no one else having, you know, access? Should not the supply siders or the consumers potentially have access to this network that they are all, say, take Facebook, they're all collectively creating? It feels a little lopsided. It feels a little too good to be true for an investor in the value capture that they get under the equity model.
But that's just the reality of life, right?
That's the reality of the social fabric that we have created over the last 400 years, but it's not a naturally occurring phenomenon, right? This is a social structure that only exists between our collective minds. And so we have the capability as a society to change that.
So as also you said, again, a lot of this is predicated on being able to create something that's, you know, faster, cheaper, better.
Yeah.
And
or novel.
Or novel, yeah. And without that and being able to access create a significant number of users that actively use a system, none of this will matter.
Yes.
So at the moment, there seems to be a real problem in achieving that. We've had, I would say, hundreds, potentially thousands of attempts now. And there's nothing that stands out of having cracked any form of product market fit. A lot of people talk about killer apps. We just don't seem to be seeing it. I've got my suspicions of why, but I'll let you go first before I tell you what I think.
Sure. Well, I think we're still very much in an infrastructure phase. And there will be killer apps that pop up along the way. The Silk Road was a very early killer app, right? That converted a lot of people.
But the infrastructure phase is a myth, apparently.
Well, so USV, Danny and Nick from USV put out a good post about the back and forth evolution, right? And I think that is the point, right? The infrastructure improves to a point where we have a breakout app. It may not be sticky, right? Like AOL, for example, was a breakout app for a period that wasn't, say, sticky over many decades, at least not on a large scale. And so you have this oscillation, infrastructure app, and each one pushes the other, one pushes and enables the other. I would say that, there's a few responses to this. Let's say taking things that are working. We recently put out a thesis post on MakerDAO. MakerDAO in its first year originated roughly the same amount in loans as Lending Club originated in its first 5 years. That is stunning, right? Granted, it's a different kind of loan. It's a secured loan for MakerDAO versus an unsecured loan. But I would say that when you see a network provisioning a service and scaling roughly an order of magnitude faster, or say at least twice as fast, you know you have something going on there. And that it's really, and I really should say a protocol, because a network can be, say, equity capitalized or crypto asset capitalized. But when you have a crypto asset capitalized protocol-based network scaling much faster than you've seen in the equity world, that is really the openness of the system empowering all participants to use and further the service at a rapidity which you almost can't have because of how closed and concentrated an equity shareholdership is. It's almost like an equity shareholdership, and I've never thought of it this way before, but it means we're getting into good places in this conversation. It's almost like an equity shareholdership is a proprietary thing, right? It's not an open source thing. It's not an open, anyone come and join and pitch in ecosystem. And we've seen how open source software evolves much faster than proprietary software. And in the asset model, I think you can make a roughly similar analogy in terms of these crypto assets are an open source asset, whereas an equity is a proprietary asset that, you know, is very hard to get access to unless you're inside the club. And so those, by and large, won't be able to scale as fast. Now, totally agreed, we are still searching for the right product market fits for these crypto networks.
Next up, I talked to Chris more about why he believes in a market for tokens and dealing with Bitcoin maximalists. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. So Kraken, they've got a big announcement regarding security. And yeah, this announcement was really cool, actually. It just validates why I love Kraken so much, why I'm so glad to be working with them. They are the cryptocurrency market leader in security. It is their number one priority above anything else. They just want to protect their clients. Highly relevant with everything that's happened with industry hacks. They've got a new blog post from their chief security officer, Nick Pococo. He has written an open letter, and it's really interesting. I recommend you go and check it out. He's got a couple of announcements. Firstly, that they've enhanced their two-factor authentication by enforcing it on login, making security core to all Kraken user accounts, which is obviously very cool. And secondly, this is amazing. They have launched Kraken Security Labs, a commitment to improving the security of the entire crypto ecosystem. Not just them, but they're going to perform vulnerability research against third-party products, hardware wallets, software wallets, and other related technology. And if they find any issues, they're going to disclose this in a way that does not jeopardize the security of the industry or their clients. Their goal is really just to improve the security of the entire industry and protect their clients. This is really, really cool. This is typical Jesse investing in the industry as a whole. And this is why Kraken are the only exchange I'm going to be working with. So this is taken directly from their blog. Definitely go and check it out. Definitely go and read it. Nick himself is super interesting. He's got a two-decade history as an active member of the security industry, and I'm definitely going to get him on the podcast at some point. I think it would be really cool to do a show all about security. So join me in supporting Kraken. They are the number one crypto exchange in the world. Head over to kraken.com, which is kraken.com. And back to BlockFi and back to working with them to answer the questions about their interest accounts. I said it in the intro. I'm going to say it today. I'm probably going to say it on Tuesday as well, but Zach has opened up the floor to everyone. If you're interested in the interest accounts, you've got questions, you've got concerns, Zach has said, come on, write to me. Well, Write to Pete. If you write to me and tell me your questions, I'm going to get on the phone with Zach next week. I'm going to put all of them to him. Then we're going to stick up on SoundCloud all his answers to everything that you've asked out there for everyone to listen to. I think it's super cool. It's super transparent. It's exactly how I run my podcast. It's why we get on so well. So yes, if you've got questions around BlockFi's interest accounts, email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. They will definitely get put to Zach. And if you're interested in these interest accounts, just head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. So MakerDAO is an interesting one. So as I've kind of bumped into and sympathized with the whole maximalist view and Bitcoin being the only need for a blockchain, MakerDAO is the one that keeps coming back to me, and I keep saying, okay, I can't ignore this. But then MakerDAO itself is predicated on, its success is predicated on the fact that ETH is a store of value and appreciates in value, and that people who have ETH historically have made enough money to then use it for MakerDAO. But it's not particularly useful for anyone new coming in who doesn't pre-own ETH, because you have to then buy ETH to then get a collateralized loan from MakerDAO. So I don't see that as a kind of great mass use case example. I see that as just like a small use case for people who've already have a substantial stack of ETH. Do you see what I mean?
Well, so I would say that when you look at MakerDAO's roadmap, which they've very credibly executed on, and so we can say with reasonable certainty they will continue to execute. First, they're going to move to multi-collateral, mm-hmm. right? And so it won't just be ETH. And it will continue for the foreseeable future to be constrained to the Ethereum ecosystem. But that's not a forevermore kind of thing.
Do you think it's a risk that it is tied to the ETH ecosystem?
I think it's a risk, but it's not an intolerable one.
Okay.
And I think, you know, we've seen one iteration of, say, second layer protocols migrating from operating on top of Counterparty, which was on top of Bitcoin, to Ethereum. And I think that we may see a similar migration in the future, depending on what happens with Ethereum. These things are flexible. They're adaptable. Mm-hmm. They're plastic. But with MakerDAO, I think if you're bullish on the directional growth of crypto assets, then you should be bullish on MakerDAO as an extremely low-cost credit facility. And I think of it as first and foremost a credit facility that outputs a stable asset that also happens to be widely used. And so I agree right now it is predominantly used as a means to gain leverage for, you know, investors in ETH, but use cases tend to start off, you know, high value, low velocity for a specific user. They originally look like a toy or niche, but that's really what hardens the service to the point where it can become more mainstream accessible.
So what other assets could it be used for? I mean, it could potentially be used for a wrapped Bitcoin.
Theoretically, any ERC-20.
But therefore, so again, its success is predicated on the success of Ethereum or things built on Ethereum. But if...
For now,
unless it becomes its own independent blockchain.
Or we don't know what the interoperability world's going to look like, right? And this is where, you know, where in crypto, it's kind of like we're driving down a dark road with our high beams on, but we can only see so far. But I would say that it's a technology problem to create interoperability of state and value between different base layer chains. And when that is figured out, which I have every confidence that it will be, then it will become easier for middleware protocols, and I actually wrote a piece on middleware protocols on our website, to get this supra chain scale, right? And be able to pull resources and users from different chains. We saw one example of this very recently with Loom, which is operating on top of Ethereum to begin with, but has just offered support for EOS and Tron. And yes, there's controversy around EOS and Tron, and I understand that. But it's interesting in and of itself that here we have a middleware protocol already starting to provide interchain support before, say, the interoperability that has been a buzz within the ecosystem has really become a reality.
Right. Okay. So this is where I then start to worry about maybe the ethical nature of some of this. And look, I don't want people to be restricted from investing. I don't like investor accreditation. I think they're archaic rules and unfair. But at the same time, I do wonder whether really we're still in such an experimental stage that these systems should be financed and supported by retail investors. And I worry about, I mean, I've been there myself. I made and lost a lot of money very quickly. And by transparently talking about that story, I've had an incredible amount of people contact me and tell me similar stories. And a lot of people have lost a lot of money. And I know this happened during the dot-com boom, but we've lowered the threshold for investing by making it very, very easy with services like Binance. So I then worry about...
The siren is how we know we're in New York City.
Yeah, yeah. I worry about how ethical some of these crypto funds are who are promoting a narrative of a future of blockchains and tokens, who are investing early on in projects and protocols, yet are able to extract value and exit before anything has been proven as a success. And I think that's where I prefer the old world of equity investments as opposed to now, because a lot of these funds could make a return without actually any of the projects being a success.
Yes. And I think the key linchpin there of what's changed is the pathway to liquidity, or the bar to liquidity, is much lower, right? And so the concern I hear you raising is that a institutional investor can get liquidity and exit an investment much more easily and potentially return a profit, even though it was a useless asset. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the traditional equity markets, it has been so groomed over time, right? We're 400 years in now into the evolution of the equity markets. It has been groomed over time and is so commoditized, say, in all of the operations and how everything is understood, that it has a much better filter for filtering out the junk, and the things that should die do die before they leave a institutional investor's balance sheet and hit retail. So I think it's a important concern.
It's not always the case though, right? Because obviously we can look at something like Snapchat or Pinterest.
Not always the case.
Yeah. So those themselves are still yet to be proven, especially Snapchat. Snapchat to me as a IPO itself feels very similar to some of the ICOs in that its share price really struggled after it.
Well, and you're kind of pulling us into a broader conversation around venture capital, right? Yeah. Because there's a whole nother side conversation totally unrelated to crypto around the ballooning size of venture capital funds. I mean, placeholder as a $150 million fund seems big to crypto, but when we talk with institutional investors, we're a small fund. Mm-hmm. We're a small venture capital fund, boutique. And so, you know, part of the frenzy around venture capital has been because for certain venture capitalists, the returns have been so good, right? And also as a uncorrelated asset class to, say, traditional public equities and bonds, there's been a lot of appetite for that. But when there's a lot of appetite for that, it balloons, you know, the fund sizes and therefore the asset prices. And Ben Evans from Andreessen Horowitz has a great presentation that shows how private companies are staying private for longer and raising more money and, you know, all of these things, and that a lot of the value is being captured in the private market before it even goes public. So it's actually almost the inverse problem of what crypto has, right? The traditional equity market, and again, I'm just kind of thinking through this with you on the fly, but the traditional equity market, these companies, you take something like Uber, has stayed private for so long. You know, it's now whatever, $50, $60, $70 billion company by the time it goes public, that, you know, a 10x from there, and it's a $500, $600, $700 billion company. Whereas, say, when Microsoft IPO'd, the returns, I think, were in the hundreds of X's or thousands of X's, which is insane, right? But in the public equity markets, because people were going public early on, there were lower pressures and requirements. And so that's our traditional equity world. And you could argue, and I think Fred Wilson put this either in a tweet or a blog post, in a way, crypto assets are a backlash against that, right? Of early to liquidity, as early to liquidity as you could possibly imagine. And this is, I just think, another cycle of each generation wants to be new and do something different from the generation before it. And society is this constantly swinging pendulum where we go too far in one direction. And so we swing back and we go way too far in the other direction. And we occasionally hit these sweet spots where things run well, but, you know, inevitably swing too far in another direction. And so it's going to be a constant evolution. I think for myself as an investor, you know, to be clear, I never thought I would work in finance, right? My parents were educators. I was raised around the world. They taught at international schools. I was raised to kind of think of finance as the devil and never thought I would be where I am today. And so I have a bunch of considerations and say insecurities about say what I'm doing and how am I contributing for better or worse to income and wealth inequality and what I do, right? And so I would never want placeholder to have a profitable investment that didn't provide true utility for the world. How we handle that is an ongoing conversation, right? Do we just let a asset that's part of our portfolio that is pumping, do we not sell it because we know that it's an artificial pump or, you know, it's not at all tied to fundamentals? These are very serious ethical questions, which we take seriously and we engage with on a regular basis.
And have you as a fund exited tokens during a pump?
We haven't.
Have you exited any tokens?
We have not sold a single thing.
Okay.
And again, this is where we're very different from a hedge fund, right? Mm-hmm. We are not traders. I think of us as buyers in bear markets, sellers in bull markets, and you end up being a liquidity provider on both ends of the spectrum. When everyone is selling, you buying, you're a liquidity provider. When everyone is buying, you selling, you're a liquidity provider. And it can actually help dampen the volatility of our constituent portfolio assets through that process. But I would say that, you know, we, as a venture fund, we build these large positions over time, work very closely with the teams, and we are still discussing internally about how we handle the exit process. And do we do it incrementally? Do we do it, you know, in one fell swoop? Of course, we communicate with the team. How much do we communicate with the market? Our very name, placeholder, really reveals everything you need to know about how we think about ourselves. We are a placeholder helper, placeholder hodler within these networks that, yes, must ultimately exit the investment. But hopefully, it is at a point where the thesis has played out, the network no longer needs an institutional investor. And this is kind of going back to our earlier conversation of, you know, should we get a claim on value capture forevermore? Or should we just serve our most important purpose early on in the life of a network and then leave the vast majority, the vast remainder of the pie for the supply siders, the demand siders, the core developers, when the network is really starting to inflect in its fundamentals?
What happens on year 10 when the fund closes? Do you have to exit every position and close the fund?
So we have what's called a limited partner agreement, so an LPA with our investors who are our LPs, our limited partners. And basically, it's a 10-year fund, which means our investors can't withdraw or claim their capital legally for 10 years. We also have 2 1-year extensions where we could go to our advisory board if we have, say, assets that we think still need a couple more years. So it becomes a more flexible process. It's really, say, just I like to think of it as this cocoon of capital to allow us to not be distracted by the markets and to really focus on the task at hand.
Do you worry at all about being able to exit because of low liquidity?
Absolutely.
Because it seems to me there are a lot of funds who hold a lot of tokens, but these markets are highly illiquid.
Sure. Yes, it's definitely something I think about. It's lots of people know we're highly involved with Decred. And one of the things I work a lot on is having conversations with different exchanges and liquidity providers about the merits of Decred and helping to organically build liquidity that way. I think for Decred, it's important that it build liquidity. I think that different assets are going to have different required liquidity profiles. So for example, governance assets, it might actually be okay if they're slightly more illiquid. That might actually be more of a feature than a bug in preventing, say, a hostile takeover very easily, because there'd be so much slippage in the market if someone were trying to amass a large percent of the asset. So that's one consideration within the liquidity realm. I think we're going to start to see much more segmentation in the capital market structure of crypto assets in terms of, you know, we've been predominantly exchanges and OTCs have really risen to prominence over the last few years. And now we're seeing things like Tagomi as a prime brokerage, or OmniX, which is aggregating all of these different liquidity pools. And so you will start to see different assets having liquidity in different places for different reasons.
I assume you've discussed Decred with Murad.
At length.
At length. Yeah, I was with him in Hong Kong, and he's told me, and a lot of people seem to know that he thinks he's very bullish on Decred. I don't know anything about it, to be honest. Okay, so look.
Well, we wrote an investment thesis on it. That's also on our website. Just very simply, it is, I think of it as Decred has it. It is hyper secure, adaptable, and sustainable. And that kind of gives you the framework that you need to dig in more.
So I do want to go back to one of your points you said to me about that you feel that the hardcore Bitcoin maximalists, I call them the hardliners, that shout loudly on Twitter do more harm than good for the mass adoption of the currency.
They can.
So I think it's interesting to talk about that, because I've been really wrestling with this. And even this morning, I had before I came here, I had an hour-long conversation with Shinobi, who was on Stefan Levera's podcast, a hardcore Bitcoin maximalist, because there's been a lot of questions over my guests recently. I've had people who are considered frauds and scammers, and almost certainly this interview will get flack because it's a Bitcoin show, supposedly, and they're not your biggest fan. They don't appreciate the work you're doing because they believe in one blockchain, which is Bitcoin. They believe everything other use of a blockchain is a myth. They believe that crypto assets are a myth and they're not part of the same category. So,
well, Bitcoin doesn't believe any of that. Bitcoin doesn't believe anything. Bitcoin just is.
Let's say Bitcoin is.
But it's this community.
Yeah. So, and again, I have a lot of sympathy for this because I still struggle to see all the use cases after all this time. And I've looked at the various tokens you can invest in, and every time I go down these, I'm like, nothing now gives me a gut feel that it's a worthy investment. You obviously have a different thesis because you're a fund and you look into it in more detail. But I used to think, and I've gone through times of thinking, the hardline maximalists are damaging and toxic. I now think very differently. I actually think their absolute necessity, their hardline approach, it's almost like it doesn't matter if this delays adoption. The hardline approach protects Bitcoin, and Bitcoin needs protecting because it has so many threats.
So I don't think Bitcoin needs protecting.
Oh, right, okay.
I think that going back to the commodity theory of money thought trail that I laid out earlier, Bitcoin's doing amazingly well, and it will continue to price and be the bloodline of liquidity for pretty much every crypto asset out there. And that actually by berating new people who come to the community or people who have differing ideas, that actually counteracts the momentum that Bitcoin naturally has. You know, you mentioned me, say, as someone that maximalists dislike. What's interesting is I've had a whole arc, the Bitcoin community. Right. In 2014 and 2015 and 2016, even. I mean, if you look at 2015, I put out two white papers, one Bitcoin, a disruptive currency, where we actually put in that white paper that Bitcoin could hit $17,000. That was celebrated, right, by the Bitcoin community. Or the Securing the Network paper, it was really doing deep research on, and just specific to Bitcoin, because that's really all there was of note at the time. Ethereum had just launched. Looking at what the transaction fee would have to be when Coinbase rewards phased out. The new asset class white paper, really just digging into tons of stats on, you know, Bitcoin's returns, Bitcoin's volatility, risk-adjusted returns, really contextualizing it for institutional investors. ARK was the first public fund manager to invest in Bitcoin, right? That, again, brought a wave of goodwill. If you go back in YouTube shows in time, I was on with Vortex a couple of times and had different conversations. I mean, different friendly exchanges, for example, with Mr. HODL. I think there's one memory that comes to mind is posted a photo of me with a Bitcoin beanie, and it was clear I was in New York, and he said something like, keep wearing that and we'll run into each other in New York. And so I started... I think it would be, you know, overinflating my self-importance to say, you know, cherished by the Bitcoin community, but an embraced member of the Bitcoin community early on. And so I, from my first person experience, have watched as, you know, I started to explore and just ask more questions, and not in a, I didn't intend it to be in a threatening way, the backlash that that started having. And I think that there are a few scenarios on Twitter that I could have handled differently. And I think that it's never good to fight fire with fire on Twitter, and that it only amplifies and negativity. You know, you need to be, say, a positive vessel and just absorb negativity and not reciprocate it, because then you only amplify it. And so, you know, Twitter has been a meditative tool, I would say, for me in that regard. But I don't really have much of a feeling, I think, anymore regarding maximalists. I think that intellectually, I worry that if we're trying to take Bitcoin mainstream, that means the vast majority of users will not be educated about the merits of Bitcoin. They won't care. They just won't care. They will actually be turned away if they feel like they have this screaming mob asking, you know, why the hell did you use this other asset? Because they're just trying to use things that are faster, better, cheaper, or novel. I think that, you know, something very controversial to say, let's take Coinbase, right? Coinbase as an application has done a massive amount of converting of people into Bitcoin hodlers. And it's not through the, say, preferred self-sovereign custody model, but I'm willing to bet most people don't want the pressure of the preferred, of our ideologically preferred self-sovereign model. And so I think this, a lot of this ties, say, very deeply into the way I live my life, and guided loosely by different Eastern philosophies. But it's kind of a, you know, the vitriol, the negativity, the hate, I find totally unnecessary and not constructive. And I don't think that Bitcoin needs to be defended in such a way. And I think it's counterproductive to defend it in such a way. And Bitcoin actually defends itself perfectly well of its own merit.
Okay, so I guess where I would give an example of, I think it was useful, was SegWit2x. We had a private New York agreement with companies attending.
A fight intra Bitcoin, though, interestingly, right? Not tokens against Bitcoin.
Of course, but this is entirely focused on Bitcoin. If SegWit2x had activated and the core repo would have gone over to, I think, Jeff Garzik's team, I'm shooting from memory right now, I think that was a huge risk. I think it was defended, and rightly defended, but because there were people like John Carvalho going into the threads, and there was people like the hardcore maximus who were threatening, like, the companies in a physical way, but just making them really understand what they were doing was wrong. And the deal fell apart because there was so much anger and so much hostility towards it. And also, look, we have to also thank Luke Desch Jr.'s UASF, but there was so much hostility towards it. And I think that requires some kind of hardline approach. And I think that requires people who do feel they want to defend it. Without that, because Bitcoin's been under threat its whole life, its whole existence. And I don't think it can be defended unless it has those people who are willing. I heard one guy say, I would die for it. No, I don't think we should die for it, but I understand the sentiment.
Right. So you raise a good point, and I actually want to walk something back. I think that Bitcoin thus far in its life, because you're right that it has been under attack, and it's been under attack from traditional finance and these kinds of things. I think that thus far in Bitcoin's journey, it has needed to be defended in this way and with, say, extreme conviction and ideology. Part of my point is Bitcoin is like a tree, right? Or like a child, in that it grows and it starts off green and it needs to be protected. But as it unfurls, it enters different stages. And if we really are committed to the mainstream, then the rhetoric either needs to change, or it will be buried, you know, in the wires such that it's irrelevant. And I actually think the latter is probably more likely, which is why I don't beat the drum on this too much. And I just kind of let it be where it is, because social media is not a constructive place to have these conversations anyway. Mm-hmm. It's too nuanced, and social media is just going to want the emotion and the fire. But I think that, you know, I would encourage the community to be mindful about the progression of what's necessary and to not alienate people who are, you know, just thoughtfully raising questions. And another way to think of it is every community is going to have governance, or maybe better put as every community has to make decisions. And there's always going to have to be a choice about the pathway for how those decisions are made. And not setting up a framework is a decision in and of itself, right? And that is the choice of governance. And I understand governance is a loaded word, but just using it as the best example we have now, you know, taking that into account and understanding, okay, so this is Bitcoin's chosen form of governance. And, you know, that I think also for Bitcoin, it's okay that it have, say, some of this. I think it moves faster than people think it moves, but I don't think it needs to say move as fast as Ethereum does, just because of the value proposition that it provides to the world. We've gone on a bunch of different threads.
I know.
Which one would you like to...
Yeah, we've bounced around a lot and covered a lot of things. I'd like to talk about the Coinbase thing at the moment.
Okay.
So one of the arguments that the Bitcoiners have against Coinbase is that whilst Coinbase originally supported Bitcoin, it's been good for Bitcoin, it's onboarded a lot of people, it also is arguably been a threat to Bitcoin. Being VC funded to a valuation of something like $8 billion at some point, it has to deliver a return. And there, of course, comes pressures. And I assume A16Z have a voice in their direction. And I assume A16Z hold a lot of ETH. And I assume Brian Armstrong holds a lot of ETH. So there is a...
But they also probably hold a lot of Bitcoin too.
They hold a lot of Bitcoin, but there is a necessity for them to introduce people to unproven crypto assets. By the way, which is it's kind of interesting because it's still very difficult for some institutional investors to invest in Bitcoin because we've had such a delay in getting an ETF approved. Mm-hmm. Yet at the same time, it's very easy for an uneducated retail investor to go on Coinbase and buy 0x, something they probably shouldn't be buying or arguably shouldn't be exposed to. What the bear market is exposed is, I think, Coinbase's need to deliver a return for the Silicon Valley investors. And therefore, it seems like it's almost like their product strategy reflects a big drop in revenue and a need to kind of push and compete with the likes of Binance. And that to me does feel very unhealthy. And I can then understand from Bitcoiners why they see Coinbase as a threat, because Coinbase's incentive is to make money, not to promote Bitcoin. And Bitcoin isn't meant to be about supporting VCs and growth and investor returns. It's meant to be about providing hard decentralized money. And there's a conflict there.
So I would say this is the newest narrative, right? But there's a long history between Coinbase and the Bitcoin community.
Well, I guess because Brian Armstrong has supported most of the contentious forks.
Right. But if you go back, say, to Coinbase's founding, and even when I was ramping professionally in the space, there was still, you know, there were still people who would pick fights with Coinbase because it's hosted, right? Or, you know, different security concessions. And I think just maybe something that repeatedly happens is an inability or an unwillingness to see and accept another entity's perspective. And it is what it is. And they're going to do what they're going to do, and they're going to have a different value system than your value system. But no amount of yelling, kicking, screaming is going to change it. And so we can have rational, thoughtful discourse around it and understand why everyone is doing what they're doing. But you don't persuade people with expletives. You persuade people with logic and reason. And you laid out the logic and reason for what they're doing. And I think it's one of the reasons why they're doing what they're doing. I don't think that... So I know Fred Ursa much better than I know Brian. And Fred's no longer with Coinbase. Actually, a lot of the people I know well are no longer with Coinbase. But I have never felt in conversations with any leadership at Coinbase that there was any malicious or nefarious intent against Bitcoin.
No, but business has pressure. That's that's the problem, that, you know, it's quite obvious. They used to have a very strict set of rules for releasing tokens. That's become very relaxed. And I think it's very difficult to argue anything other than revenues have dropped. They have competition from Binance. And I think possibly, like, Bitcoin is kind of in some way this weird gift. It could have not happened, but mm-hmm. it has. And for some reason, it's worked. It's still here after 10 years. And it really is. It's genuinely.
It's a miracle.
Yes, it is a miracle and a gift to the world. And then I start to feel like, yeah, maybe we do need to protect this. Maybe we do need to defend it with all we've got, because most other things out there in this kind of crypto asset world are opportunities for people to make money. And there is some kind of pseudo equity model, as we've discussed today, where people have invested early on and they want a return. Whereas Bitcoin is kind of, it's kind of different from everything else. And, you know, you talked earlier, I wrote this down, but you said the we've seen a collapse in the cost of asset creation. And that's created this incentive for people to create tokens and issue ICOs for selfish, fraudulent, scammy reasons.
But also for good reasons.
Sometimes, yes, but both have happened. But Bitcoin is kind of like, we have this gift, and I understand now why people want to defend it, because I know now myself in what I do. I don't want to, I've talked about my podcast. It's changed my life. I get to travel the world, meet people. I don't want to fuck it up.
Yeah.
I do not want to fuck this up. And I am fully now conscious that I have a podcast with the Bitcoin in the title, and I owe a lot to Bitcoin. And I have to, so I'm conscious that I do not want the wrath of the maximalists. And I'm glad I have that.
But I also don't think you can be afraid of the wrath of the maximalists, right? If that becomes its own form of censorship of speech, that makes the community more brittle. You know, we learn from biology that diversity of species leads to robustness of the ecosystem. And so I think that diversity of ideas is always going to be important. And I think that something I worry about with what we've seen with Bitcoin, and not just Bitcoin, broadly in crypto, because of the ease of forking and that most of this communication happens online where people are meaner than they are in person, we have these divisive arguments that are never reconciled. And so we just end up forking, saying, fuck you, I'm out of here. And so we have governance by defection, as opposed to recognizing that life is always a compromise. It's a compromise with yourself and your own priorities and, you know, how much time you can fit in a day. And it's a compromise with others and your interpersonal relations. And when you blow it up and expand it to the scale of a crypto network, it gets even messier. But I think that it's really important, as much as possible, to continue to evolve and craft together, as opposed to just continuing to splinter. And this is a lot of our thinking behind Decred, right? Finding, if we set the expectations around governance and communication and conflict resolution, then hopefully we as a community can agree to disagree in different periods, but collectively move forward. And I think that is the most constructive way to do it. Otherwise, you know, you go back to this community that whittles away and governance by defection, and I just don't think that's that healthy. Now, for me on a personal basis, I hold two things. I hold Bitcoin and I hold Ether. I guess I have Bitcoin Cash from the fork, which I never sold because I learned to not sell Ether from the Ethereum and Ethereum Classic fork. And I guess I have all the children forks, which I haven't bothered to go claim. But I hold those two things as a retail investor. And I do that because, you know, I don't want to think about it. I have reasonable conviction in these two assets going forward. And I manage a whole portfolio for placeholder. But I think it's perfectly rational for a retail investor and probably advisable to just hold those two assets. Or, you know, you mentioned Monero, totally different code base. I think, you know, that's an interesting addition. I actually used to hold Monero before we started placeholder. But yeah, keep it simple if you're investing from a retail perspective, and especially in this bear market, you know, there's a consolidation to safety, a psychological reversion to say the things that we know. Bitcoin has been much more proven. And so if you're only holding Bitcoin, that's fantastic. At least you're holding Bitcoin.
Do you know what I find really interesting is that there are a considerable number of people with a very binary view that Bitcoin is the only valid use of a blockchain and the only crypto asset that will exist, and have the fundamental belief that everything else is a fraud and a scam and will eventually fade away, including Ethereum. And then there is another group of people who fundamentally believe that there is multiple uses for a blockchain and there will be multiple crypto assets. I find it so interesting that we've got these two groups of people with these opposing views. And I honestly, I genuinely don't know what's going to happen. Like, I don't know in 10 years time, all the maximalists are going to go, yep, look, we were right. Ethereum's dead. Decred's dead. Nothing has survived. Or in 10 years time, we're going to have this vibrant ecosystem of blockchain-based systems. My suspicion is that it will be only Bitcoin.
So, and you are entitled to your opinion and your first-person subjective experience. I would say empirically, it has only been trending in the other direction over time. And I think the first altcoin, Namecoin, if that was it, but in the Namecoin, Feathercoin, you know, all those things era, which I believe was 2011, a rendition of this conversation was already being had. We're 8 years in. We've gathered a lot of empirical evidence. A ton more money has flowed in. A ton more talent has flowed in. And the majority of it is not with Bitcoin. Bitcoin has the largest percentage of any crypto network. And I think will continue, will always be the mother. And I think has high odds of continuing to be the bedrock for decades to come of the crypto ecosystem. But directionally, it's only going in that direction. And so I'm a very data-driven person. I will change my mind and try to have very little ego in my ideas, because that's the death of an investor, being attached to your ideas for no good reason. I will change my mind and change my ideas if I see it heading in the other direction. But empirically, I'm just seeing more and more talent and interesting things being built, say, outside of Bitcoin. That is not to discount what is happening within Bitcoin. I think there are amazing things happening within Bitcoin. But for me, it's not an either or. And it goes back to the world of programmable value. Like, if you look at the world's assets, monies are, you know, represent, I think, roughly 10% of the world's assets. There's so much more. And so I kind of feel it's like, you know, when you see horses on the road and they've got those blinders, I just don't understand the blinders.
Well, talent is subjective. I mean, somebody could say all the best talent is in Bitcoin because they understand it's the only use. So I think talent's subjective. I would say...
But what about someone like Zuko?
I mean, I would say Zuko is a very intelligent person, a lot of skills. But I also think he's the kind of person who would excel as somebody having a boss, not as a leader or a CEO of a privacy coin. I think Zcash has many, many issues. And I don't see a future for it, and I don't see it being adopted. I think the clash between shielded and unshielded is very odd. I think the user experience and the price has only gone one way. It's just dropped and dropped. So talented guy. But what I've noticed is there's a lot of people who worked on Bitcoin and then go and work on altcoin projects for a number and a variety of reasons. But I don't think it's right to say there's more talent in one area or the other, because I think talent is subjective. You know,
it is.
Some people would say I'm a talented podcaster. Some people say I'm a terrible podcaster. It's subjective. Also, directionally, it's definitely on certain metrics going one way. There's lots of things being built, lots of supposedly interesting things coming out. Polkadot, Cosmos. Yeah, I struggle to keep an eye on them because I'm starting to pay less interest to most of them, because what the maximalists would say is we've been here for 10 years and we've seen these cycles. Money comes in, projects happen, then they die. Nothing else has lasted with the strength of Bitcoin. You know, it's very hard to kill a blockchain, right? But
well, nothing else could have lasted as long as Bitcoin, because Bitcoin's the first.
No, but with significant usage, there is a real lack of materially significant usage of anything. I mean, even Bitcoin at some times, well, I spoke to an OTC desk, a guy manages an OTC desk. He said, Bitcoin is the only sensible, tradable, liquid crypto asset. Nothing else is worth having on their OTC desk. So understanding direction it's going, because there is this belief by people and there's money coming in from venture capital to prove that these blockchains can be used for something else. But that doesn't mean it will.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
It absolutely doesn't. I think when I look at metrics, and I understand the problems with network value, but, you know, Bitcoin's dominance being its network value divided by network value of all crypto assets outstanding is generally trending down. I would love for someone to do, and maybe we'll do it internally if no one does, but just looking at, you know, as flawed as all of these metrics are, but I think there's an interesting study to be done on, say, you know, the network value. If you take the aggregate capacity of all these different metrics and look at Bitcoin's share within it, things like network value or number of transactions or transaction value or hash rate, or even, say, percent of networks that have proof of work based versus proof of stake based, all of these other things are taking share, not because they're better than Bitcoin, but because there's only so much that can happen within Bitcoin. And Bitcoin, being the community that we've described it as, is not necessarily the most welcoming, right, to a new developer coming to the space. And so people are choosing to build on other things, and they may be half as talented, they may be a tenth as talented, but the experimentation is happening. And I'm willing to accept if it all becomes a failure. But again, I just directionally haven't seen that. And when I look at Ethereum stats, for example, you know, amount of gas used being really the key, say, a utility metric, that has held up much better than actually Bitcoin's core metric of value transacted. And that is developers. So I wrote
why is value transacted a core metric if it's a store of value?
Of the network's, say, processing capacity. I agree store of value, say, is kind of this latent feature. But if you're going to use the network for something active as opposed to passive, I would say that transaction value is, say, the most active utility, the most important active utility metric.
Okay. Well, I would struggle with that because it's a store of value. So, and it's had its, you know, scaling difficulties as everything had. So I personally would struggle with that.
But I wrote a piece in December when everything was tanking, just called Bitcoin and Ethereum Prices Are Down More Than Fundamentals, where I actually went through an exploration of all the different fundamentals, at least as much as I could do in half a day, and wrote it up just to show, you know, things are still happening. It's and if you turn away and if you mistake depression for, you know, death, then these things will continue to blossom and grow and become unexpected successes, I believe, you may not believe, in the year to come or in the years to come. But I think the important thing is you and I have no animosity for each other, right? This is a good conversation. This is a rational, level-headed, engaging discussion. And I just want more of this, right, in the crypto community as opposed to the toxicity.
Yeah, definitely. I've really enjoyed this. We could probably do another hour.
We could.
We would almost certainly do this again in the future. I've got a lot out of it. I still stand by thinking the hard line, I think they're necessary. I really do. I think they, you know, I feel like I have the freedom to do as I choose. And I choose to do this interview, and I've enacted it in a way. Nothing has changed about the way I would have done this interview because of the hardline maximalist. I don't feel like I can't have my curiosity, but at the same time, I'm fully aware. I feel like they're sat here on my shoulder, just watching over me saying, be careful, Pete.
Well, you've, from their perspective, you've just gone and gathered information from the enemy.
Yeah. Well, you're part of the threat model. But no, I mean, I appreciate what you've done. I would be interested to read your book again now, because the last time I read it was about a year ago. I've actually got a little stack of them at home.
I'll have to sign that one.
Well, you know what? I'm stupid. I should have brought two, because I would...
I've got an extra.
Have you?
I'll give you an extra.
So I would like one and probably give one out as well. But no, I appreciated the book at the time. It was very useful for me for a number of reasons, but I would almost be interested to read it back again and see how I feel about it now, because I've changed a lot since then, but...
I'd be curious to see how I feel about it if I...
Yeah. Well, that's why I asked you at the start. I was wondering what you would think, because there's certain things that have had a lot of pressure, like the... What's the MVQ thing?
Sorry, equation of exchange.
A lot of people have challenged that. Velocity has been challenged, right?
Sure.
And so I'd be interested to see where you went with it again, but I think this feels like a good point to wrap things up. I don't often record for an hour and a half. So actually, what I've noticed is the less I look at my laptop, the more I just talk, the longer the interviews are. So for some reason, it seems to work better. Anyway, it would be great to just tell us what's coming up for you guys. If people are interested in Placeholder, how they can find out about Placeholder and who you want to hear from.
Well, we're always making new investments and open to conversations with engineers working on interesting projects. Placeholder's website is just very simply placeholder.vc. I'm on Twitter at cbernisky. And... you can find me on other messaging mediums, though I'm more elusive.
Thank you so much for having me here, finally.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Okay, so what did you make of that? Did you enjoy that discussion with Chris? What was quite interesting for me, actually, was recently I've started to try and do some of my interviews without a screen full of questions, because some of the times I felt when I've got the questions, they're distracting me from what the guest is saying and having such a to and fro debate. So with this one, I kind of ignore my questions and just try to openly discuss with Chris. And I felt this one led to a much more open and better flow of conversation. So yeah, be great to get some feedback on that. Tell me what you think. I really enjoyed this chat with Chris. It's probably another one of my favorite interviews. And while I'm skeptical on the market for altcoins and tokens, I believe that Chris honestly believes in the market. And hey, look, it will either happen or it won't. For me, it's important not just to dismiss everything as a scam. While there certainly are a bunch of scammers out there, and I understand and sympathize with maximalists, they've watched this come and go, and people come and go with these stupid ideas that don't work. But I think Chris believes in this, and I think he believes in it with honesty and integrity, and I'm willing to listen to it. I'm willing to understand if there are new business models. And even if I'm not willing to buy into it myself, I want to understand why others are interested in this market and why they think differently. I think it helps for shaping the conversation, and it helps for deciding some of the shows I want to do or framing some of the conversations. And it was also good to get into maximalism with him. He himself has been at the wrath with his work and his book, and people question his motives and basically saying his professional reputation is based on the success of crypto assets. So it was good to talk to him about that. And also, Chris is a Bitcoiner. You know, he is a long-term Bitcoiner. He just also has this other interest in crypto assets. So yeah, I like the guy. I would love to chat to him again. I really enjoyed it. I really appreciate him giving me time to do the interview. And if you do have any questions about it, you know you can reach out to me. And to everyone who supports the show, I just want to say a huge thank you. Every week I say this and things tick over. You know, I get a new patron or more reviews appear on iTunes, and all of it helps with the show. All of it helps me just trying to create as much great content as I can. So look, if you do like the show and you want to support it and you think this is the week I want to help Pete, well, here are the things you can do. Firstly, just listen to the ads. If you're a regular listener, that 1 or 2 minute of ads, that really does help. I get regular emails from people saying they've listened to the ads and yeah, they've signed up for something. So that's really helpful to me, because without the sponsors, I couldn't do this. And if you don't want to listen to the sponsors, then become a patron. It's only $5 a month and you get the shows early and without ads. I'm up to 90 now. I can't wait to hit 100. I don't know why. It just feels like a cool number. So thank you to everyone who does that. That's really cool. But if you are interested, it's patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. If you don't want to use Patreon, but you want to subscribe with crypto, drop me an email. I'll send you a deposit address and add you to the distribution list. I now accept Lightning payments, which is pretty cool. You can buy some merchandise. I've got loads of What Bitcoin Did stuff. T-shirts, hoodies, caps, and mugs. I've even got a jog on hoodie. Now, I'm not taking any of the profits with this. All of this is going to go towards buying Lightning Nodes for people. But if you want to buy some merchandise, just head over to my website. There's a link there. You can become a show sponsor. If you're interested in this, then email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. March was completely sold out. I've got one slot available for Lightning Month in April. I've got one slot for May. So if you're interested, reach out to me. I'm going to do over 200,000 downloads this month, which is utterly crazy. I thought I would have a dip after last month. So thank you to everyone who's helped make that happen. You can leave me a review on iTunes or just click on the subscribe button. Both help with my rankings in iTunes. You can follow me on social media. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Medium. I'm at What Bitcoin Did on everything. My personal Twitter is at Peter McCormack. DMs are open. You can check out my website, whatbitcoindid.com. Getting to that time where it needs some more work, so I'll have to find some time to do that. You can sign up to my newsletter, and you can share the show out with your friends and family. So, right, thank you. Thank you for listening to that every week. I'm sorry if it's a pain. Right, I'm back in Bedford now. I had a great time in Hong Kong and in the States. Thank you to everyone for the hospitality, but time to get back into some hardcore work, producing good content. I've got a bonus show that's going to come out this weekend on sex workers and how crypto can help them. I need to get that out before Lightning Month starts. And I'm also starting work on my specials for the ATM industry and mining. They will come out probably in May and June. I'm also working on ideas for specials on the Silk Road and S2X. So look, my focus is just on creating as much great content as possible. If you want to reach out to me, just get in touch. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And I look forward to hearing from you.